This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I just saw a pretty remarkable film called The Rider about a Native American rodeo rider and horse trainer who's recovering from a harrowing rodeo accident and might no longer be able to ride again. You won't know the people in the cast. They're not professional actors. They're all playing slightly fictionalized versions of themselves. We're going to be joined by the film's star, Brady Jandrew, who was badly injured in a rodeo accident, and the film's writer-director, Chloe Zhao. Zhao is a Chinese-born, U.S.-based filmmaker who shot this film and her 2015 film Songs My Brothers Taught Me on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Brady Jandrew, Chloe Zhao, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this beautiful movie. Brady, I want to ask first, how are you now? Have you fully recovered from your head injury? Are there lasting effects you're still dealing with?
I struggle with a little bit of like short-term memory stuff. But other than that, I mean, I pretty well recovered.
And so you're riding?
Not in rodeos, but I'm training wild horses again. I was a month and a half after my head injury.
Wow. What actually happened to you?
I was participating at the PRCA Rodeo in Fargo, North Dakota. And I was riding in the saddle bronc riding. And I was nearing the whistle and trying to stay on for the 8 seconds to get a score. And I come off the side and my foot hung in the stirrup and caused me to swing underneath the horse. And the horse stepped on my head while it was bucking and pulled me out of the stirrup and it crushed my skull. It was a comminuted fracture, meaning shattered, and it was 3 1/4 inches in length, 3/4 of an inch wide, and about 1 1/4 inches deep into my brain cavity.
Oh my God.
Caused a significant amount of bleeding. I actually didn't lose consciousness until I went into a seizure at the hospital, which was only like 11 minutes away.
So now you have a steel plate in your head?
I don't think it's made out of steel because it doesn't beep when I go through the monitors. I believe it's actually like titanium or something.
I see. Do you have memories of the actual accident?
I remember the horse bucking away from me. I remember the bullfighter coming up to me who was helping and telling me to stay down. They're bringing a stretcher and all that. And I was trying to get up and they're like, no, you got to stay down. You got a broken neck. And they started treating me for a broken neck. And I said, no, my head. It's my head. I can feel my feet. Look, I can move. They're like, don't move your legs. Don't move your legs. I was like, I can move them. It's my head. And they started to kind of look at the wound on my head. I had very long hair at the time, and the step actually didn't puncture my skin very much. It was like a small cut, and the bleeding, about 90% of the bleeding, if not more, was going on inside of my brain cavity. And because of the small puncture, not very much of it was able to come out. My wound was listed as contaminated, because it had horse manure and sand and hair and other things in there. And I was conscious, cleared to the hospital. And when I got there, they started asking me questions. And I went into a full body convulsion seizure and they induced coma and did surgery.
Wow. Now, you know, in the movie, your character, who's kind of you, I mean, you're playing a version of yourself, watches getting thrown and stomped on a video that was made of the event. Is that the actual video of what happened to you?
That is 100% the actual video.
What was it like for you to watch it?
I've watched that, you know, dozens of times. To be honest, that phone is broken now, so the only time I can watch it is when I watch the movie. But I don't have much of a problem with that.
With watching it?
Honestly, I kind of like to think of it as it didn't really happen to me. It happened to Brady Blackburn.
Oh, to your character in the movie, yeah.
Yeah.
In the opening scene of The Rider, you're waking up from dreaming about horses. We don't yet know that you're waking up from, I don't know if you're first waking up from the coma or not, but you look in the mirror, you see the bandage on your head, you take a razor, you cut off the bandage, there's a long row of staples holding the incision together, and it looks to me like you take out a couple of the staples.
And then I took out there were staples that were holding the bandage on.
I see, okay.
Yeah, in real life, I didn't actually have staples in my head. I had sutures,
mm-hmm.
but there were staples that were stapled that stapled the bandage on my head. I had six staples I had to remove, and I removed those with my knife, the same knife that I used in the film, actually.
Wow. And then you wrap your head in plastic, you know, like plastic wrap that you'd use to
keep
the
wound
dry.
Otherwise,
yeah.
I was on a lot of high-grade antibiotics,
mm-hmm.
and because my wound was contaminated, I had to keep it very, very clean. And actually, believe it or not, water was one of the main things that could cause it to become more infected.
Oh, I believe that. So you
soap in, kind of.
Yeah. So you wrap your head in plastic wrap so that you can take a shower. Chloe, why did you start the movie with that scene, with him taking off the bandage, taking out some of the staples, wrapping his head, and stepping in the shower?
Well, the film starts with a dream, you know, and that's a dream Brady had in real life when he was,
in the coma,
and he dreamt that he's a horse himself, and that horse is being trained and being, you know, a saddle is being put on the way they put a neck brace on him.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really inspired by that dream, and we filmed actually some hospital scenes and was going to intercut it, and it didn't really work for me. It feels like it wasn't in Brady's perspective, so we decided to have him wake up from the dream. And to take off that bandage, I think it's just to put the audience right there, bang in the middle of his experience.
Right in the middle of the wound.
Yeah, right in the middle of the this is what this film is about. There's mm-hmm. a dream of a horse, and there's a wounded cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will start a journey from there.
No, I mean, your doctors told you you couldn't ride again, and that you certainly couldn't do rodeo again. I know someone with a relatively minor concussion who had trouble riding the train afterwards because it was such a dizzying experience because of the concussion. Real concussions are so much worse than they're always made to seem in movies, like where the detective gets whacked on the head with a pistol, he's knocked unconscious, he wakes up with a headache, and that's the last we hear about the concussion. You know,
yeah.
It's not that way in real life. But it sounds like you started riding like long before your doctor said that you should do it. What did the doctors tell you? How soon did you start riding? And did you do it sooner than they said you should, like I think you did?
Okay, so on April Fool's Day of 2016 was the day I was injured. And like I said, I went in there and then they did surgery and they induced coma. It was over a 5-day span because I woke up officially on the 5th. But on the 4th, I woke up and under the induction of coma and pulled the respirator out of my chest and started to pull my IVs out and they did a breathing test to see if I could breathe on my own. And I failed the first two tests and then I passed the third one. And then they figured, okay, it's time to drop the induction, see if he can wake up. You know, they had a pretty good idea I could because I was waking up under the induction. So they dropped it, and I woke up. I couldn't talk right at first. I had very blurry vision in my left eye, and I couldn't. It sounded like my left ear was filled with water. I'm not sure if that was blood in my ear or what, but after that, they told me, I need to stay there. I have to stay in the hospital. And I told them that I'm not going to. I'm not going to lay here and rot. And they said, okay, well, we can't legally hold you if you can take your medication orally, go to the bathroom on your own, perform daily tasks such as walking, dressing yourself, other things like that. Take medication in pill form. And I walked the line like I was 17 walking for the cops, you know, after I had too much to drink. And I told them my eye was good, and I told them that everything felt great, and they needed to let me out of there, and I took the pills, and then they walked out of the room, and I threw them up in the trash can, and I was out of there. So got down the road a little ways, had a pinch of Copenhagen, ate a chuck wagon. I've been pretty well good ever since. But I never returned to the hospital at all, and then I couldn't take it any longer. 2 weeks after I got home, I rode Gus again, which is a very well-trained horse that it was like a brother to me growing up. I mean, if you can imagine an animal being like a brother to someone. So I had a lot of trust in him, you know. I knew I was pretty well safe. And a month and a half after the injury, I actually went flat broke. And unlike in the movie where I work at a grocery store, I went back to doing the only thing I know how to do and what I love to do, which is training wild horses for the public.
But the thing is, like, you're supposed to, after a head injury like that, you're supposed to, I think, prevent your brain from getting jostled. Yeah, so but the point is, you've been ignoring what the doctors say, and it's not advice I'd give other people, but I'm really glad that you're okay. Was giving up rodeo hard? Because that you never went back to. Like, that was too risky even for you to think of doing.
Well,
again.
To be completely frank with you, ma'am, I'd say training horses.
Oh, it's more dangerous?
Is more dangerous because it's so unpredictable. Mm-hmm. The only thing that you can predict their actions through is your connection with the animal. And like, say, I mean, even if the horse stumbled and fell down, like my dad a few months ago broke his leg when a horse slipped and fell down on him. Mm. If like a horse were to fall down and I were to hit my head off of a rock or a post or anything, you know, typically I'm about 55, 60 miles from any reputable hospital when I'm training horses, and a lot of times it's just me out there. So.
Okay, you haven't reassured me, but that was a very interesting answer. The scenes in the movie where you're training horses are so just beautiful to watch. And, like, are we seeing you train horses for real in those scenes?
Yes.
Wow, it's just beautiful. And, you know, one of the things interesting to me is that the first thing you do in those scenes when you're training a new horse is put out your hand for the horse to sniff. And that's something that a lot of us do when we're meeting a new cat or a new dog. And it's interesting that that's the first thing you would do with a horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a horse, you know, they can't say, hey, how are you? I'm so-and-so, you know. So they communicate through typically smelling or, you know, just body language. And when a horse approaches another horse, the first thing they do is they smell noses. If I were to put my face up close to a horse, he'd probably be a little bit intimidated. So, like, a horse's neck is long, like an extension, just like my arm. So I'd put my hand up to their face and let them smell it, just like I'm another horse approaching them to, you know, smell their nose as well.
Do you think there's something in it for the horse when the horse develops a relationship with a human and learns to accept that the human's going to ride them and also feed them and care for them? Like, I know what's in it for the people. What's in it for the horse?
Well, you know, when a horse connects with you, there is something in it for them, because, like, for their health, and I believe also in a relationship with a person. Like, many horses we save off of kill trucks. They take horses. Well, there's no legal slaughter of horses in the United States now, but there's still legal slaughter of horses in Canada. So, like, typically when a horse... there's like a horse that has never been trained and he's much too wild or much too old for your average trainer to have a go at him, they'll typically sell him, and nobody can ride the horse, so he typically goes and becomes glue or dog food or whatever, you know, sent to France or the horse Apollo in the movie was one of the horses that I actually saved off of the kill truck.
Oh, you're kidding. This is one of the horses you tame in the movie. A beautiful horse.
Apollo, he was probably 8 or 9 years old, and he was really wild and really big. You know, most people wouldn't have messed with him, but I seen something in Apollo that you don't see in every horse.
It's a beautiful buckskin.
Yeah, even though he was he's big yellow. Mm. And even though he was... He was wild. I felt as though he had a lot to offer. He had a very, very, when I look into a horse's eyes, they say more to me than you have said to me in this entire conversation.
Thank you.
No offense. Well,
no offense to you, but that's...
It's how Brady relay. He relays to horses more than people.
Yeah.
It's okay.
And Apollo, he would have had to go to a kill truck, but I knew there was good in him. And so I broke him. He was difficult to break. And for the first, you know, about 2 months we owned him, nobody else could ride him but me. But once he was finished out, he was probably one of the best horses I ever rode.
Chloe, what you do in your films, or at least in the first two films that you've made, is cast people to play slightly fictionalized versions of themselves. It's not just Brady who plays a fictionalized version of himself. His father is in the film playing his father. His sister is in the film playing his sister. His friends are in the film playing his friends. Let's start with his family. Did you have to work hard to convince them to be a part of the film? And I'll mention that his father isn't always painted in the most flattering light in this. His father has gambled away the rent money. So, like, the family is totally broke in the movie. I don't know if it happened that way in real life, but, you know, people will confuse real life with the fictionalized version. So how is his father with playing this role?
Well, this is why Tim Jandrew is his dad's name, and his character's name is completely changed, not just the last name. It's Wayne Blackburn. Because Tim in real life, I think is a better father than I portrayed him in the film, you know. But I think, you know, this is a fiction film, and I this is how I explain to everyone who's involved. You're free to keep your real name if you want to, and you can be as comfortable to be yourself as possible. But you are playing fictionalized characters, so. You know, Tim would probably feel comfortable with me saying that he's made some mistakes as a parent, like all parents do, but it's not like that in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad, I mean, we've had our ups and downs, you know, just like any father and son probably has. But, you know, we get along really good, honestly. You know, I mean, everybody makes mistakes, but, I mean, that's what I mean, you know, everybody, you know, yeah. So, I don't know. My dad is... For lack of a better term, not as much of an asshole as he's in the film.
He's old school. He's old school. Yeah.
Chloe, how did you first get the idea of combining real people and real people's lives in a fictionalized version?
It sort of happened both by just the natural flow of things, but also by accident, because it was very difficult for me to raise money to make my first film. And then ended up, I had a traditional script, very conventional, and I was casting on the reservation, and I met a lot of young people who were great to play these roles, and I in the process had been rewriting for them. But then I lost the money, could not make the film after 3 years. So I ended up making a film with a tenth of the budget, and some friends, and a treatment. And that was a really hectic and messy learning process as a result of my first movie. And through that process, I discovered something I really love to do. And I was kind of wanting to go deeper with the characters for the second one and keep it small. So when I met Brady, I thought I found the perfect person to carry that film.
So it was, in a way, a result of your resourcefulness when faced with, like, no money. How do you make a movie?
Yeah, actually, mm-hmm. You know what? Yeah, because, like, you either work with limitation or you let it work you, you know. We, as a woman, Chinese women filmmaker with not much connections, and to come to America and say, like, I want to make films on a reservation with kids there, back in 2010 to 2013, it was a tough time for the country financially, and for the industry, for everybody. No one was gonna just throw me money to do it. So, you know, it was a blessing in disguise, because that style come out of for us to be friends with the limitations that we have, including the way we shoot, the time of the day we shoot, you know, who we cast and all that stuff, and how we run the set.
So, Brady, what is your life like now? I know you're still working with horses. Like, what exactly are you doing?
Actually, since the shoot, I've started a breeding program called the Jandrew Performance Horses. We raise American Quarter horses, all registered through the AQHA, and we train them to do everything from rodeo events to, not the bucking events, of course, the other events, such as the timed events, where you ride a very well-trained horse to perform a task. And I also train them to do, like, mounted shooting, hunting horses, just pleasure riding horses, about anything that you could name, we could train. So.
And where do you get your horses from now?
Well, I raised them, and I also take
in horses.
Oh,
so it's a breeding,
horses.
Right, it's a breeding program.
Yep, and I also take in horses from the public to be trained for mm-hmm. a set number of days mm-hmm. For a specific amount of pay.
How many horses do you have now?
We have around 20 registered brood mares, so that means about 20 babies born each year. You cannot break a horse until they're about 2 years old. You can halter break them, meaning teach them how to lead and stuff, if you choose to, but you can't really break them until they're two because they aren't developed enough, you know. I mean, it'd be like a five-year-old playing football or something, you know.
Are you around when the horses are born? Are you there for
yeah,
the birth?
Yeah. Well, typically, some of them, they go off and hide, and they've had, you know, numerous babies. But sometimes mares, you know, especially on their first baby, their first foal, they'll need a little bit of assistance.
One of the reasons why he didn't come to Cannes when the film premiered, he's very devoted to his horses.
Oh, so you were home with the horses during the Cannes Film Festival?
Yeah.
They were giving birth.
Oh, it must be amazing to witness that. I guess you're used to it.
Yeah, it's something else, though. I mean, it gives you the chills every time. I mean, I don't know, horses are so, they're almost like a spirit rather than an animal to me, mm-hmm. you know.
I want to thank you both so much, and I want to congratulate you on the wonderful film. Thank you.
Well,
thank you so much. Thank you.
Brady Jandrew stars in the new film, The Rider. Chloe Zhao wrote and directed the film. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Female Persuasion. Maureen says there's a lot going on here in this story about feminism, friendship, and the ideas and people you embrace and outgrow. Here's her review.
One of the two women at the center of Meg Wolitzer's absorbing new novel, called The Female Persuasion, is a legendary feminist named Faith Frank, who's in her 60s when the story begins. Faith seems to be modeled on Gloria Steinem. She's charismatic, sexy, and witty. We're told that Faith is no firebrand. Rather, her talent was different. She could sift and distill ideas and present them in a way that made other people want to hear them. In the age of identity politics and intersectionality, however, Faith is often slammed for being too mainstream. The magazine she helped found, called Bloomer, is mocked by one of its upstart competitors, a radical blog called Femme Fatale, for providing nothing more than pep talks to straight, white, middle-class women. As a novelist, Meg Wolitzer herself shares many of her Steinem-like characters' strengths and perceived weaknesses. Wolitzer is one of those rare writers who creates droll and entertaining novels of ideas. Her novels aren't experimental, nor are they particularly diverse, though she makes an effort to be inclusive. The Female Persuasion is about a lot of things: the arc of the feminist movement, female mentorship, and the inevitable moment when a younger generation comes to judge its elders as lacking. But The Female Persuasion also makes a strong case for what the critic Lionel Trilling called the enduring relevance of the novel of ideas as a critical tool against overconfidence, particularly the blithe overconfidence of smart people, radical, liberal, or conservative, who think they've arrived at readily satisfying solutions to political and personal questions. As Wolitzer dramatizes, life isn't that straightforward, and art shouldn't be either. The Female Persuasion opens in 2006 when a first-year college student named Greer Kadetsky goes to hear Faith Frank speak on campus. Greer is smart but unfocused. Her hippy-dippy parents haven't given her any direction, and her most significant relationship is with her high school boyfriend, Corey. The son of Portuguese immigrants, Corey landed at Princeton, while Greer is marooned at the fictional Ryland College, where, as she dryly notes, her dorm room walls were the disturbing color of hearing aids. A place like Ryland wouldn't have snagged a celebrity like Faith Frank in her prime. But as our omniscient narrator tells us, Faith is now seen as someone from the past. She was like a pilot light that burned continuously, comfortingly. Listening to Faith's talk that night, however, Greer is smitten. Afterwards, a nervous Greer bumps into her new idol in the women's room and blurts out to her, "I don't really know how to be." It's a small, sincere moment that will transform Greer's life. Years later, she'll go to work for Faith's Feminist Foundation. And because this novel hops around in time, we also know that Greer will become famous herself and eventually supplant her foremother, Faith. Like Wolitzer's best-selling 2013 novel, The Interestings, the female persuasion manages a sprawling cast of characters. Among them are Greer's queer college roommate, Z, who herself tries to mentor the young after graduation by working for a Teach for America-type organization, here wryly called Teach and Reach. The post-Princeton path of Greer's boyfriend, Corey, is even more compelling. Corey sets out to be a high-flying financial consultant, but a family tragedy pulls him back home to care full-time for his mother. Eventually, he even takes over her house-cleaning jobs to make ends meet. In short, Corey performs women's work. Ironically, that's a situation that doesn't sit well with Greer, the professional feminist. There are a few false notes in this novel, chief among them, the ultimate confrontation between Faith and Greer, which echoes the climax of another female mentor tale, The Devil Wears Prada. But overall, Wolitzer nimbly avoids the canned and simplistic. Midway through the novel, Greer reflects on her ambivalent need for Faith's approval. The approval, she thinks to herself, was soft as velvet, and the desire for that approval was, also like velvet, a little vulgar. If we readers have been lucky, we've had someone in our lives like Faith, someone who inspired us, someone who we, maybe overconfidently, now think we've outdistanced.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Female Persuasion. Coming up, we'll talk about Rodgers and Hammerstein with Todd Purdom. His new book is about their creative partnership. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein had one of the most successful musical partnerships of the 20th century, collaborating on the musicals Oklahoma, Carousel, South Pacific, The King and I, Flower Drum Song, Cinderella, and The Sound of Music, musicals that continue to be revived. In the new book Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway Revolution, my guest Todd Purdom tells the story of their partnership. Purdom loves their music, but he's best known as a political reporter. He's now a contributing editor for Vanity Fair and senior writer for Politico. Let's start with one of the Rodgers and Hammerstein songs that have had a long life beyond Broadway. This is Sarah Vaughan and Miles Davis doing their version of the song It Might As Well Be Spring, which Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote for the 1945 movie musical State Fair.
I'm as restless as a willow in a windstorm. I'm as jumpy as a puppet on a string. I'd say that I had spring fever, but I know it isn't spring.
Todd Purdom, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So before there was a Rodgers and Hammerstein, there was a Rodgers and Hart. Rodgers and Hart had a very long partnership. Hart's death officially ended their partnership, but it was already ending. So before we get to how Hammerstein entered the picture, why were things between Rodgers and Hart so rocky at the end?
Well, they'd been close friends and partners for more than two decades, Terry. But as you point out, as 1942 rolled around, Larry Hart was increasingly falling prey to a problem that had plagued him for years, which was severe alcoholism. And he really was almost completely dysfunctional. He didn't want to work. He told Richard Rodgers he wasn't interested in working on adapting a play called Green Grow the Lilacs, which is what became Oklahoma. He said he wanted to go off to Mexico. And Rodgers said, if you go off to Mexico, all you'll want to do is drink. And in fact, when they brought him home, they had to sort of pour him off the train on a stretcher. So it was really a tragic moment in their long friendship.
So at the end of the Rodgers and Hart partnership, Rodgers was ready to kind of leave Hart if Hart didn't stop drinking. He even offered to go to a sanitarium with him. But what happened was Hart just died. So Rodgers then teamed up with Oscar Hammerstein. How did their relationship start?
Well, they'd known each other for years. Oscar Hammerstein was a contemporary of Larry Hart's at Columbia University, and he had known, and of Richard Rodgers' older brother, Morty. And Rodgers had known him starting as a teenage boy when he went to see the annual spring varsity show at Columbia, and made up his mind then and there that he wanted to go to Columbia and write a varsity show too. So they'd been in touch for many years. So there were family connections. They grew up in the same part of Manhattan in what's now East Harlem. But they had been in each other's circles, and they'd certainly known of each other over the years. They'd actually even collaborated on a couple of songs for a varsity show when they were younger men. But what happened was Hart was still alive. He didn't actually die until after Oklahoma premiered, but he was unable to work. So Richard Rodgers approached Oscar Hammerstein. Actually, he approached him when he was in Philadelphia working as a silent producer on a show called Best Foot Forward. And Oscar had a farm in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, in Bucks County, not far away. And Rodgers went out to see him and asked him if he'd consider collaborating with him because he thought Larry was falling apart. And Hammerstein said, well, as long as Larry can do the work, you have to stay with him because it would kill him if you left him. But if he can't do the work, then I'll be there. And that's what happened.
So Oklahoma was considered a breakthrough. What made it a breakthrough?
Well, for one thing, almost all musical comedies of that era opened with a big choral number to satisfy latecomers, the rustling playbills. They'd get them adjusted. They'd have a display of pulchritude across the footlights with dancing girls and boys singing a big ensemble number. But Oklahoma began the same way that Green Grow the Lilacs did, with a woman churning butter on the stage and a cowboy singing off stage in the wings. And it was quiet, and it was so quiet that it landed like a bomb. It was revolutionary. Nobody could sort of believe that a musical comedy would open in such a naturalistic way. Then it proceeded to unfold, and the story's very simple. As I said, it's about which of two guys is going to take a girl to a party. But it involved real characters and real people with real emotions, and not some cartoonish figures that were strung together just as an excuse for having some wonderful songs. And then it did another thing, which was that it used dance, and particularly Agnes DeMille's ballet, as a way of propelling the story forward, of exploring and explaining the characters' innermost thoughts and feelings and fears. And it wrapped this all up in one package that just felt completely unlike anything that had ever appeared on Broadway before. It was received in 1943 the way Hamilton is received today, as something really radically new in the theater.
So Green Grow the Lilacs, the play that Oklahoma was adapted from, was written in France by a 29-year-old gay cowboy turned poet and playwright who was from Oklahoma. And you say he was trying in that play to capture his nostalgic feelings about growing up in Oklahoma before it was a state. So Hammerstein worked the stage directions into his lyric for Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, which is one of the songs from Oklahoma. Would you read the stage directions, and then we'll hear the song, and we'll see how Hammerstein worked in the stage directions into the lyric?
Here's what Lynn Riggs wrote in the stage directions of the prologue to the play. It is a radiant summer morning several years ago, the kind of morning which, enveloping the shapes of earth, men, cattle in a meadow, blades of the young corn, streams, makes them seem to exist now for the first time, their images giving off a visible golden emanation that is partly true and partly a trick of the imagination, focusing to keep alive a loveliness that may pass away.
Okay, so do you want to say anything about how that was worked into Oh, What a Beautiful Morning before we hear the song?
Well, so Oscar Hammerstein took that kind of ripe passage of prose and turned it into the first poetry that he ever wrote to give to Richard Rodgers in the opening lyrics of Oh, What a Beautiful Morning.
Okay, so let's hear it. And this is Alfred Drake from the original cast recording.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling, everything's going my way. All the cattle are standing like statues. All the cattle are standing like statues. They don't turn their heads when they see me ride by. But a little brown maverick is winking her eye. Oh, what a beautiful morning.
So that's from the original cast recording of Oklahoma. My guest, Todd Purdom, is a journalist who's written a new book about Rodgers and Hammerstein called Something Wonderful. And that Something Wonderful is one of the songs from the Rodgers and Hammerstein show, The King and I. So another thing about Oklahoma is that, you know, it's considered the first or maybe the second Broadway show that actually had a cast album, although cast albums weren't then what they are now.
No, they were actually albums full of 78s in brown paper sleeves. But the genius of Oklahoma was that Decca Records decided to record the original cast, the original orchestrations. They put it out, and it was such a success that from that point on, it became the normal pattern for a successful Broadway show on the Sunday afternoon after the opening to record an album. And in those days, we have to remember that these songs were on the top hit parade of American popular music. They were the songs that people heard all over the radio and in dance bands and orchestras all around the country. This was the top 40 of its day.
The female star of South Pacific was Mary Martin, who later starred in Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music. Why don't we hear Mary Martin singing the title song from The Sound of Music? Do you want to say anything about how Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote this song before we hear it?
One thing to keep in mind as you listen to Mary Martin sing this song is that she was almost 46 years old when the show opened. She was playing a young postulant. But the conventions of theater were such that older actors and actresses often played younger characters, and she had trained for this role like a fighter. She took Pilates classes, which were unknown to the general public then, but already favored by dancers. She worked out with a punching bag to strengthen her diaphragm and strengthen her voice. And so when you hear her sing this, just keep in mind that this was not a young girl. This was a mature woman playing the part of a young girl.
Okay, so here's Mary Martin.
Hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for a thousand years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears. My heart wants to beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to the trees. My heart wants to sigh like a chime that flies from a church on a breeze. To laugh like a brook when it trips and falls over stones in its way. To sing through the night like a lark who is learning to pray. I go to the hills when my heart is lonely. I know I will hear what I've heard before. My heart will be blessed with a sound. And I'll sing once more.
That was Mary Martin from the original cast recording of Sound of Music. My guest, Todd Purdom, is the author of the new book, Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway Revolution. We've been talking about Rodgers and Hammerstein's hit shows. They did have a few flops, including Allegro and a show called Pipe Dream that was based on John Steinbeck's Cannery Row. So this show, it's funny, like that you write in your book that they turned down two opportunities for other shows to do Pipe Dream, which ended up being a huge flop. What did they turn down to produce?
Well, they turned down what eventually became My Fair Lady and what eventually became Fiddler on the Roof. So, you know, their batting average was not perfect.
Right. Okay. However, I'm going to play a great song for a minute in a moment. But first, this is an interesting story because it's kind of set in a house of prostitution. One character is a madam, one character is a young girl who becomes a prostitute. I've never seen the show. I've only heard the cast recording. But apparently this was not necessarily the perfect material for Oscar Hammerstein, who had a reputation as being a little prudish in his writing.
Yes, and Rodgers, too, in his own way. And John Steinbeck said at one point to Oscar, you've turned my prostitute into a visiting nurse. And the problem was that Rodgers and Hammerstein couldn't really quite bring themselves to make it clear that this was all happening in a whorehouse. They kind of cleaned it up, and it seemed a little bit like a USO post or something. So I think critics and audiences alike reacted with puzzlement to the show because it, unlike so many of their other shows, it didn't really have the courage of its convictions, and it didn't go all out to really explore the grittiness of these characters. But a couple of the songs really did get at that.
Yeah, and there's two songs I really love from it, but this one is called Everybody Has a Home But Me. And in the original cast recording, it's sung by Judy Tyler, who played Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring on Howdy Doody. And I have to say, I was just listening back to the original cast recording last night. Her singing, with all due respect, isn't good on it. And she doesn't put across the song. Her pitch is kind of wavery. It's just not, you'd never know what a great song it is, in my opinion.
Well, and she's too brassy for the character. The character's supposed to have a vulnerability underneath. And I think that she sounds a little bit too much like a belter. And that diminishes the impact.
However, when Encores did a revival of it just a few years ago, Laura Osnes sang this song, and she was recently in the revival of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. She's got a beautiful voice, so let's hear her singing Everybody's Got a Home But Me. Will you set the scene for us about where the song fits into the show?
Well, this young prostitute has just arrived in Monterey from San Francisco on a bumpy overnight bus ride. She's feeling pretty bedraggled, and she's trying to explain how she wound up where she is in Monterey on the waterfront, the scruffy waterfront of Cannery Row, and this is her story.
Okay, here's Laura Osnes.
I rode by a house with the windows lighted up, looking pretty as a Christmas tree. And I said to myself as I rode by myself, everybody's got a home but me. I rode by a house where the moon was on the porch, and a girl was on her fella's knee. And I said to myself as I rode by myself, everybody's got a home but me. I am free and I'm happy to be free, to be free.
That was Laura Osnes from the recent Encores revival of the Rodgers and Hammerstein flop, Pipe Dream. So do you love that song too, Todd?
Yes, when I first heard that song, I had never really known the score of Pipe Dream until I started to work on this book. I was overwhelmed with the beauty of the song, and I asked Ted Chapin, the head of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization, how can I not have known this beautiful song? Because I think it's actually one of the most haunting melodies Richard Rodgers ever wrote. It's just a heartbreaking, and beautiful words, a heartbreaking song.
Yeah. So how do they handle having such a big flop in which they lost their complete investment?
Yes, for the first and only time they invested their own money in the show, and they lost everything. They went on. The problem by the mid-1950s, when Pipe Dream premiered, was that they were so busy being Rodgers and Hammerstein and tending to all their multifarious business interests, and the movies were being developed during this same period, and television specials and so on and so on, that I think they had a hard time doing their best work. They were so busy managing the sprawling enterprise they'd created that they didn't have time to sit down and do the hard work of writing shows and songs. And it shows. It really shows that they rushed the writing of the book of Pipe Dream. They committed to the theater. They have a big advance sale of tickets already sold, and they had to deliver regardless of whether they were really ready or whether they'd done their best work. And it's a kind of a poignant reality that their very success in some ways inhibited their creativity.
Well, Todd Purdom, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Terry.
Todd Purdom's new book about Rodgers and Hammerstein is called Something Wonderful. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.